And today we are so fortunate to have Richo Czech as our guest. And Richo is the owner with his family of the medicinal herb seed company, Strictly Medicinal. Richo has been blessed with great curiosity and passion for the medicinal plant world. He has used his talents to write three wonderful books, Making Plant Medicine, The Medicinal Herb Grower, and Growing at-Risk Medicinal Herbs. These are wonderful books full of practical information from a man who really does get his hands quite dirty mixing soil and planting seeds. They are very readable and have charming pictures drawn by his daughter. Many of you may recall Horizon Herbs, which was the former name of Strictly Medicinal. The seed company has been a trusted friend to herbalists for many years, and this is the perfect time of year to get your seeds. These are very reliable seeds, and even the catalog is a joy to read. Richo also has a blog that is full of information about creating great soil, planting seeds, and of course, salient information about specific herbs. Richo travels the world tracking down medicinal plant seeds from literally everywhere. Many of his experiences are written up on the blog. He writes some reflections too, which is why, such as why open pollinated seeds are important. So today we have him on the show, and welcome Richo to Holistic Health Perspectives.
Hey, thanks for all that. Peace to all of you out there.
Thank you.
You too. So we always like to start with the question of how did you get interested in doing what you're doing and starting a seed company?
Well, I was a professional archaeologist and spent 3 years in East Africa. It was back in 1976 to 79, and did a lot of excavating of old potsherds and stone tools and whatnot, and eventually I just found myself more and more attracted to the green world and ethnobotany in general, and just realized that at that early age, I was a lot more inspired by green things than old dead things, and so that was sort of the roots of the whole enterprise. I did a lot of seed collecting and planted seeds and started to understand how to match the wild conditions in domestic culture, and had quite a few successes with growing plants that that previously had not been grown or had not been so often grown. And so that was sort of the beginning of the whole idea of exploring the green world.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a seed company, though, I mean, that's a kind of major endeavor to take these little itty-bitty things, you know, and turn them into what has become a very, very important part of seed culture.
Yeah, well, you know, and we all grow in pace. I can remember back at the Rouge Barter Fair in 1986, I first laid out my wares, and I had these little, you know, seed packets with my yarrow seeds and my ashwagandha and my angelica and my black cohosh and my favorite elecampane, and I had a little carven rattle, and I was rattling the rattle and trying to encourage people to come over and see my wares.
Right.
And I rattled in peace for a day and a half, and right, nobody bought even one pack of the seed.
Oh, wow.
Nothing went out, and yet I kept the faith and continued to, you know, collect seeds and at that time, in fact, there was not even an internet, so it was a lot of correspondence was done by letters to different interested growers worldwide, and things very slowly got going, and until now, there's great demand for seeds, and that really gives me hope for people that they're planting seeds.
Yes, that's and true. I think saving people are also encouraged to save seeds now more than ever, and that kind of thing as well. And speaking of saving seeds, when you collect seeds, I'm just wondering, you know, how you preserve seeds, because that's another thing that, I mean, I know I just put them in envelopes and they go in a basket and they wait. But what are some proper ways, you know, that people can store seeds?
Well, you know, it's a bit of, even just that question is a bit of an inroad into herbalism in general, because what occurs is that at first you think in great generalities that various approaches are going to be applicable in almost every case, and then as you become more familiar with the plants as individuals, you realize, wow, each one of them really does have its own individual characteristics and requirements. Like valerian seed really only lasts in dry storage for 2 years. Mm-hmm. The same with chamomile. They're really very short-lived seeds. There's very little endospermal tissue there, and they rapidly degrade. And then there are other seeds. For instance, something in the Fabaceae, the legume family, like a licorice seed, you know, can live for up to 100 years because it has a very impermeable seed coat and is protected from imbibing water until it becomes, you know, scarified and planted. So you have a great deal of variability there. But in general, you know, with a standard medicinal herb like a yarrow seed or an ashwagandha seed, you know, you're going to be able to pick, you know, purify, dry store, just like you mentioned. It actually works better to put the seeds in a paper envelope and then put them in, say, a pint jar, and seal it and put it in the fridge, because cool and dry is the general rule for seed storage.
That's great. Could you backtrack just for a sec to scarified? And I'm not sure everybody who's listening would know.
Well, there's stratification, right, which is a cold, moist period, and there's scarification, which is physically rubbing through the seed coat or the testa in order to allow the seed to imbibe water. So if you want to scarify a legume, then you pick it up, say it's a hibiscus seed, you know, you pick it up and you rub it on a bit of medium grit sandpaper and try not to rub the ends off of your fingers, and you rub through the seed coat and then drop the seed in water overnight, and it'll swell, and then you know that you've broken through that seed coat, haven't you? Because now the seed is imbibing water, and then you can plant it the next day. So that's scarification, is a physical nicking or rubbing through the actual seed coat. And there are a lot of different tree seeds and whatnot that require scarification before they'll imbibe water. It's nature's way of making sure that, you know, the seed has some longevity in the soil and that it doesn't just immediately swell and then be destroyed by winter temperatures. Instead, it can stay in a dormant stage until such time as, you know, a little gopher comes by and nibbles on it a little bit, and then it comes into the back dirt of the gopher's little home, and then when the summer sun hits it and then the rains, then it swells and germinates, and you have this really rather extraordinary linkage of events which creates the beginning of life.
Right.
Yeah.
Great.
It's a magical journey. When you see plants come up like that, just volunteering, I know.
You also work a lot with soil preparation, and one of the wonderful things in the growing book talks about different soil, how to prepare it, which I think is so valuable to people, because soil is, as we know, the most important thing, and Yeah. You've got great descriptions and great explanations of how to do that.
Well, and then again, like with anything herbal, you sort of ask the plant first. You know, you, white sage. So many people want to grow, you know, salvia, apiana, and then you'll have people, you know, putting the seeds in paper towels and soaking them, and putting the seeds in peat pots, and other people planting them in potting soil. And really, you know, if you look at white sage, where does it grow? Well, it grows in sand.
Mm-hmm.
It grows in very shiny sand between rocks, and there is perfect drainage. And so if you really want to, you know, plant the seed with good success, then you plant it in sand.
Right.
You don't plant it in paper towels or in potting soil. So yeah, you look to the plant first, and if it's a sort of a standard, you know, garden plant like a calendula or comfrey, then common garden soil or even compost is going to work really, really well. But you know, it really does come back to where does the plant grow in nature, and how can you mimic those conditions with the potting soil. And a common mistake, I think, is that people keep seeds too wet in the germination phase, and they just rot or drown. And so a fast draining mix that contains some coarse sharp sand and volcanic pumice, about 1/8 inch size pumice minus, mixed in with your organic ingredients, like, you know, good home compost, just does wonders. The seed needs to feel the moisture coursing over it, and then draining, and then the seed will swell, and then you come in again a day or two afterwards, and you water again, and the seed feels the moisture and imbibes some more water, and it swells again until eventually it just can't help itself. It bursts apart and germinates. But it just, like anything in nature, like the phases of the moon or night and day or spring and fall and winter, there's this oscillation of conditions, you know. And if you create very even temperatures and a very even environment, and there's very little you know, fluctuation of water content or light, or then those plants become confused. They really need these oscillations in order to become awakened. And so you don't overwater your flats, you know. Just give it moisture and then let it rest. It's just like gardening, you know. You hand cultivate around an elecampane plant, and you nurture it, and you put your good thoughts into it, and maybe drop a little compost there and work it in, and then, you know, you go away. And you come back 2 or 3 days later, and my God, it's just, you know, the plant is glowing. But you know, it's because you gave your input, and then you allowed, and then you rested.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this kind of, you know, pulsing of energy is much more efficient than a constant primping and preening.
And I think, and I know a mistake I used to make until one of my apprentices corrected me, was soil that was too heavy, which of course is kind of the same as overwatering.
Mm. Yeah, I think if you have a lot of clay in your soil, then it makes sense to add some compost, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. But, and the sand. I mean, I was just thinking grandelia, white sage. You know, what are the, because it's an environment, you know, then we are thinking about the environment and what we can help with.
Right. And, you know, to a certain extent, it makes sense to, you know, try a lot of different species and then choose the ones that do well for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't have to have as much input. You don't have to create as much environment as what you're doing is looking at what you actually have and what does well there. And there are certain plants that, you know, will do very well in heavy sodden soils, like, you know, one of the most ancient and beautiful plants on the planet in the family lizard tail, the Sararaceae, Yerba Mansa, Anamopsis californica. You know, it takes a sodden soil. It grows in sumps. You know, so there's a plant for every soil, and it may take some experimentation to, you know, discover which plant that is, and then again among that subset of plants choose the ones that, you know, you're attracted to or that work best for the kinds of things that you need the plants to do for you.
Yeah, makes sense. It seems like it could be fun also to create different beds that represent different environments, totally, you know, different soil types, and then plant your seeds right into the beds.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of fun in that, and finding the little micro niches on your, you know, in your yard, or watching the plants as they gravitate towards the micro niches that they prefer. Like you planted the elecampane, you know, next to the driveway, and it ends up growing, you know, on the east side next to the foundation. You know, this kind of thing, there's no end to how much effort and work you can put into all of this. And, you know, as long as you're enjoying yourself and you're, you know, creating some food, some medicine, some oxygen, then, you know, it's all good. But honestly, it's impermanent, and it's really only going to maintain for as long as, you know, there is appropriateness in terms of the conditions and the plants that are there. And one thing that I always try to remember is to plant trees, you know, wherever space allows, because trees are a little bit more permanent. Mm-hmm. And when you're finished with your experiments of, you know, planting mandrake plants next to a rock, you know, in a sandy area that you've prepared and weeded, and then have to go back and weed again, and then go back and weed again, find the plants every time. Well, you know, maybe the hawthorn tree that you planted requires a little less, you know, attention, and probably will be there even after you're gone. So, it takes one tree to medium size to produce enough oxygen for one person.
Right.
Yeah. So if you're worried about global warming and the fate of Hugh Personity and so forth, then you know, plant a tree and keep it watered and take care of it, and at least that's something. You know, you're sort of breaking even in terms of your oxygen utilization, and then you need about 30 trees to sequester the amount of carbon dioxide that you exhale. Which isn't that the way it always is? I mean, the positive parts of the project are always so easy, but the cleanup is just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, that's right.
True.
You know,
yes, that is true.
I love that.
And you know, Karen and I are actually in quite different microcosms. She's in on the coast, and I'm inland, so mine is very Mediterranean. But I can always go to the coast for the nettle and the figwort and the other things like that, and she can come inland. And I even go further inland to Dona de Terra to get Yerba Santa. You know, so there's this kind of wonderful, we're in an area which has a kind of wonderful diversity. And I know you're in Williams?
We're in Southern Oregon.
Yeah?
Yep, we're at the far-flung outreach of Northern California, so we're just a wee bit mountainous here, and we have also a more or less of a Mediterranean climate.
Nice.
You know, lavenders just grow without even thinking around here, so it's just more or less Mediterranean.
Yeah, it's. I think our whole area, though, the West, I mean, there's a lot of diversity in soil types, especially
for
the first, you know, 100 miles in from the coast. There's quite a bit of variety.
A lot of change with the ridges and everything. There's just a lot. And one of the things, the catalog that you send out, I mean, I've been getting that catalog, as you know, for a long, long time, but one of the charming things, there are two things that I really love, the brief descriptions of each plant, but also the drawings. I mean, the drawings are just so refreshing. And those are your daughter's drawings, aren't they?
Yeah, that's Senna. She was one of those surprise babies that after they're born, you're like, well, how could we ever do without this person? And she has a very steady hand with botanical illustrating, and in fact is still producing. She's still producing children. She's actually gestating her third child right now. Mm-hmm. And then she's doing drawings, and I have to be really careful that I give her very healthy and happy plants, because if there's even a drooping leaf, she's going to draw the leaf exactly the way it is, and then I end up having to try to Photoshop the leaf to be upright, because I don't want people to think that the illustrations are sad. But in any case, she is still drawing plants, and then we're still producing the paper catalog. We're in the world of selling and trying to put out information that's helpful to people, but also get them to buy seeds from us, because that's our livelihood. And there's a lot of competition out there, and mostly people are producing very shiny catalogs that have bright colors, mm-hmm. and so forth, and mm-hmm. we're still producing a hand-done catalog that has hand illustrations, and we kind of feel like we walk our talk that way, because it's a little bit lighter on the planet, but mm-hmm. The good seed companies out there all produce paper catalogs, and the good seed companies out there all provide bulk seeds, for people who are need larger plantings and are producing herbal products or have contracts with herbal manufacturers. They need 5 grams of astragalus seed or 100 grams mm-hmm. of astragalus mm-hmm. seed. So we're really trying to serve everybody, the people who want to experiment with 30 seeds and the people who need 300 grams. We'd like to have correspondence and be in service to all those people, because we feel like ultimately they're in service to the planet, and we want to make it easy.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the wonderful things, is the different ways that you do have, and you have collections. Collections of seeds that I really like. You'll have a Ayurvedic seed collection that will have different kinds of tulsi and so on. And I think those are, and also some overwintering crops and so on. I think that you really provide a good diversity of seeds that are available. And then you also have the mouse. What's the mouse that Senna draws?
Oh, Cheesy Mouse.
Cheesy
was a house pet that when Senna was just about waist high, she had this pet mouse, and it was a inspirational mouse. It's kind of like mouse TV. You could just watch the mouse all day long, and it was amusing. And we had a spiritual advisor, Rinpoche, who actually gave the mouse an empowerment while it was on his shoulder. He gave it a little knock with one of his Dorjes, and then he was a very, very smart Rinpoche, because he then picked up the mouse and gave it back to Senna, and then it pooped on her. So he knew that he had prescience, and unfortunately the mouse developed a tumor, and then Santa brought it to a vet, and then it died on the operating table, and so it was a sign to us that we should always stick to home medicine. And then she drew a picture of the mouse on her wall, and instead of telling her that she couldn't draw on the wall, we encouraged her to draw more mice, and so it became a mascot of sorts.
That's quite wonderful. I mean, I think one of the things that I love about your books and about the catalog is that there is a folksiness there. There is a very grounded, it's a very authentic, both the books and the catalogs. And then that you do reflect, that you do have a reflection about why open pollination matters. You know, these are, for airheads like me, you know, these are, and I use airhead just to describe all the Libras and the other people who don't stay grounded very easily, but these things are really important, you know, to be able to pick up a book on soil and come across a reflection on open pollinated seeds. I mean, that just makes my heart sing.
Well and maybe good. And yeah. You know, I welcome everyone to, you know, check the website at strictlymedicinalseeds.com, and there's a monograph on every one of the plants. If you double click on the pictures, it's going to give you a lot of good information about how the plants are useful and what kinds of conditions they like. There's a Richo's blog clickable link at the top, which brings you to, you know, a lot of free information about cover cropping and growing seeds, and then also you know, feel free to go to herbalreads.com. You can get my books free shipping there, or even through Strictly Medicinal Seeds. I think there's shipping is free on the books, and I encourage people to get the books and you know, view the secrets of seed germination through my eyes. I've been doing this for 40 years, you know, I'm now 64. There's a Beatles song about that, you know.
Right.
Will you still read me when I'm 64? I really hope you will.
I do.
I have probably my last tome is in process.
Okay.
The Medicinal Herb Grower, Volume 2, which is 600 species. It will be sort of like a Strictly Medicinal Seeds catalog, but about 100 times bigger.
Oh.
And that, if I ever get a chance to stop shipping bulk seeds to all you interested gardeners out there, I will sequester myself on the coast at Yahats and finish TMHG Volume 2, and I hope that that will be a good gift to growers into future generations.
That's great,
and certainly something to look forward to. And pretty soon we'll open up the line to listeners who might have a question for you. But before we go on, maybe you should explain what open pollinated seeds are for people who may not know that.
Well, very simply, seeds, the way nature made them, what you plant is what you get. There's such a thing as a ecotype or a native land race, and for an example of that, we could use true comfrey, Symphytum officinale. The plant grows in nature. It is native to Europe. It produces viable seeds. The seeds drop to the soil. They overwinter, and in the spring they germinate and grow, and what you get is another true comfrey plant. It's no different from the parent, and so we call this open pollination because the plants are pollinated by bees and other insects, and they are not, you know, selected by humans. They're not hybridized F1s. They're not genetically modified in the lab. They're just the way nature intended. So that's an open pollinated seed. It is a seed that may be expected to germinate and grow and produce a plant that is similar to the parent.
Mm-hmm.
If you take hybridized plants and you save seeds from hybridized plants, then and you plant them, then you won't get a plant that's the same as the mother plant. It will revert to one of the original parents. So it's a mess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
really.
Unfortunately, you know, humans, we think we're being helpful, and instead we're just tinkering with energies that are really not meant to be tinkered with. And so open pollinated seeds are really dependable, and you know, you want to allow a large enough population when you're growing plants for the purpose of seed saving, so that there is quite a bit of, you know, variability in the population, and you keep it healthy that way. If you try to train plants to be in a box, then they become unhappy. So these populations will exhibit, you know, healthy variation. The plants in the Asteraceae, Aster family, are need to outcross a lot. They need a lot of members of the same clan to produce healthy seeds. If you just take a calendula and you grow one calendula plant and you collect the seeds and then you grow those seeds and you collect them again from one plant, then you'll get inbreeding depression, and the plants become less and less healthy, vigorous, and happy. So these are some of the tricks of the trade. You know, you can get by with a small population of plants in the Lamiaceae, like the sage family, and in seed saving. But in the Asteraceae, you want to have a lot of plants to collect seeds from. So these are some of the things that we consider when we're growing out our crops for seed production.
Yeah, well, and it's a real reason to have seed exchanges. So I'm going to remind listeners who might be tuning in right now to KZYX. This is Holistic Health Perspectives with Mary Pat Palmer and Karen Uphoff. Our guest is Rich Ocheck, and we are talking about the wonders and glories of seeds and herbs. And if you have any questions for Richo, you can call the studio, 895-2448, and that's 707 area code, and we'll take your call.
So, harking back, I think also what happens to me with that, what you just said, is like, wow, how many generations for ashwagandha are, you know, my mind instantly goes to things that I might have a mother plant of, and then plant from the mother plant. But because smaller gardeners, I think, tend to do that. You know, smaller gardeners, they might have one Krishna holy basil, for instance, mm-hmm. that then becomes the mother plant or the father plant or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And so generationally, you really would need to know specifically the family and the genus, probably, to know how that...
You do want to know these things, but, you know, bottom line, the proof is in the pudding. You know, if it's working to collect seeds from your Krishna Tulsi and replant them, and the next generation looks good, and, you know, the tea tastes good, and and the plants are happy, you know, then there's just no reason to put the worry into it.
Good.
But, you know, that's one of the values of the seed company, is then you can occasionally go back and...
Right.
And re-up your stock with plants that have been grown out a little bit more professionally.
Mm-hmm. I do want a quick thing. I got the Azteca Nicotiana, that one tobacco
okay.
that's in the catalog.
Right, the night-blooming Azteca.
Oh, mm-hmm. my heavens. I mean, it's enormous. It's had more babies than, I don't know, whoever the person who had all those quintuplets, but it's had so many babies, and they're just everywhere. And it's such a beautiful plant. I mean, the smell is great. The plant itself is beautiful. I think that one of the things for me with Strictly Medicinal Seeds is that I've used them now for, 25 years? Something like that. Long, long time. And I try to include some new ones every year, figure, hey, this will work. And also that, of course, tobacco helps control pests. So that, I think, is one of the things that, like you were saying, to go back to the seed company, to remember that it is interesting to discover somebody new. You know, there's somebody new in the garden, and look at them go. that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, it's the tobacco is so maligned, in so many different ways, and yet, it's a sacred plant, and originally was considered to be a sacred plant. And so how is it that we take a sacred plant and we make it into, an addictive, ball of chemicals? And so sometimes growing the real herb out there can be, can really help you slough off a lot of garbage, I think tobacco is an inspiring plant to grow. Mm-hmm. I can remember the first time I saw someone. It was a wise woman, on the coast of Oregon was growing tobacco, and my God, I saw the plant from a quarter mile away, and I was attracted to it, and I never really I'd seen plenty of cigarette butts on the sidewalk, but I'd never seen a tobacco growing. And so now, every year I'll grow a different tobacco. One of the great things about Nicotiana is that the germination rate actually increases in storage. And so, you can grow 10 different varieties, and every year you'll grow a different variety, and you can, resave your seed, and seed that's 10 years old is just as good as, maybe even better than seed that was grown last year.
Wow.
And it's very prolific in terms of its seed production.
It's so prolific.
Of course, you only want to grow one every year because they will hybridize, and you'll come up with unexpected crosses. And so if you have a variety that you're growing, like rustica, Hopi tobacco, then you just grow that, and then the next year maybe you grow a desert tobacco, and then maybe the next year a night blooming Azteca, and like that, and then save your seeds, and since they're annuals, then you don't have to be too concerned about what to do with the plants the next year. They're going to be gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not exactly annuals down here.
Yeah, I was going to say. I would say they they're
amazing.
Yeah, they're a little they're a little perennial down here. I noticed that with mine as well.
Yep. And which brings me.
Well, there you have the difference in environment, and it shapes our experience,
right.
Doesn't it?
It does.
And you always have to take that into account.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think one of the other just as a throw this out for the ganja growers, I grew castor, and want to say that besides helping with the gopher population, that is one of the more beautiful plants. I mean, they're enormous. They have that gorgeous red flower. I mean, they are amazing.
Yeah. I was, international travel always pushes your herbalism because you don't have access to your apothecary, right? Mm-hmm. So I was in Zanzibar, and a fellow presented to me with planter's warts that were so advanced that he was hobbled. He could hardly walk. And, normally I would excise the planter's warts and put castor oil and baking soda in there, and I didn't have, you know, castor oil. I was able to find some baking soda at a local Duca, and so I went out to collect some castor beans, because, you know, castor basically comes from Africa, and there are Zanzibar castors that are native land races, ecotypes to Zanzibar. And as I was collecting the seeds so that I could smash them and treat his feet, this wonderful lime smell came up to my nose, and I was like, what? This isn't coming from the castor plant. And then I looked down, and it was a little kibumbasi, a little osmum basil that had a lime smell that was growing all around underneath my feet, and I was standing on it, and that became kibumbasi lime basil, which I brought back with me and have propagated ever since. And, you know, thousands of people have grown kibumbasi lime basil, and it was all because I was trying to pick some castor seeds to treat a poor person who had planter's warts. And I think that kind of, you know, that kind of flash of luck, you know, occurs when a person is in service. And we all need to, you know, consider, you know, selfless service as an inroad to not only, you know, other people's health, but our own health. Very primary. And so I was really struck by that. You know, I never would have discovered kibumbasi lime basil if I hadn't been, you know, treating somebody's planter's warts.
Yeah, that's a great story.
It is a great story.
And I just want to remind listeners that if you just tried, and I can see that somebody did, tried the 895-2448, try again and stay on the line. I wanted Richo to finish his story before I picked up the caller call, but go ahead and try again. We still have some time on the show.
And how many countries have you been to now that are explicitly seed searches?
Right. And you know, you can barely even do this anymore because there are so many Nazis at the borders that you can't hardly get through with anything live besides the bacteria in your own gut. But China, Europe, South America, Colombia, and North Africa, and then also East Africa and South Africa, where my beloved aloes are so much muti, so much medicine in South Africa, so many medicinal plants. So, you know, those are all places where I've botanized, and back in the old days, I was able to bring back a lot of diversity and then grow it in our gardens here. And we have about 2,000 species that we're interested in at any given time. We've got about 1,000 species growing, and I think in the catalog there are about 600, you know, offered up for sale. So even though, you know, you see the front page is what's available in the packet, there's a lot of background work, and there's about 15 of us right now that are involved in growing and saving the seeds for strictly medicinal seeds. So that's been. It's been great, and I bemoan the fact that, you know, our borders are becoming tighter and tighter. I think that we should dissolve the borders and live as a world community. I think that's the way it was meant from the beginning. And if that was the case, then we could move the healing plants around a lot more efficiently.
Yes, right. That would be nice. And we have a caller. So, listener, you're on Holistic Health Perspectives. Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Hello? It might be a...
Can you hear us?
Hello?
Hello, I guess not. So,
it's
maybe a cell phone connection or
probably
something.
Probably a Buddhist.
Hello?
Hello? no, somehow...
She hung up.
Somehow I couldn't hear... So, there you go. I was going to ask you
meditating on emptiness.
I was going to ask you if there's any place you are longing to go and look for seeds, especially. Here's somebody
maybe
again. Let's try
back.
It again. Hello, you're on Holistic Health Perspectives. Hello.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the
keep
air.
Talking.
Keep talking.
Hello?
Keep talking.
Hello?
Oh,
no, I don't know what it is.
That's too bad. Yeah, too bad.
But hopefully we'll get another caller.
Maybe.
And Karen, you were saying.
Well, I was just wondering, Richo, if there was a place that you're longing to go and check out the plants, especially, you know, still left here.
Right. I wish I could get away from the farm and do some international traveling again, but it's becoming less and less likely at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to go back to Zanzibar. I love the white coral beaches and the Indian Ocean is the last healthy ocean on Earth, and it's good. For a Pisces, you know, to be able to swim in the warm waters and observe all the different fish and other creatures that live in the warm waters is really life sustaining, and then to be in culture because I'm fluent in Swahili, so I get really enveloped in culture as soon as I go there, and I stay in people's houses and huts and sleep on the beach and whatnot, and just get to collect a lot of seeds. One year I went there and in a month I collected 70 wow. different species of interest, and they were all taken from me when I came back through. Even though I had a import permit, they were all absconded by the authorities.
That's terrible.
Weeks later, they sent me a few basils, which included the Mrihani basil that I had collected while I was there, which is a licorice tasting osmum basilicum, and I regrew that and offered it up, and then some scientists got a hold of it and they found out that it contained a gene that preferred resistance to downy mildew to basils, and so it was used for in science X government for producing basil varieties that were growable in all the places east and midwest where they have a lot of trouble with downy mildew in basil production. And I thought, isn't that amazing that the 1/10 of 1% of the seeds that I brought back were allowed to me, and then that and they were used in the same by the same entity that had disallowed the seeds to come in. They were used by that same entity to for a very positive effect, and what more could we have done if they'd allowed me to bring
yes,
in everything?
All of them. No kidding.
Yep.
No kidding. That's a great story, and let's try this one more time. Hello, listener. You caller, you are on the air. Hello? Hello, hello. Caller, you're on the air.
And sometimes the phone
not
lines...
My fault.
No.
Sometimes the lines get...
I have no idea. But
right.
Yeah.
Sometimes the phones get, as I was saying earlier, that the archives get wonky. Well, sometimes the phones get wonky, too.
Who knows?
So, we are a small station.
Yeah, but...
In a very important little county. So, that... the travel and the discoveries, and I think, that it takes a certain kind of person to, like, I can't even conceive of doing that. I have looked at plants on the Inca Trail, that's sort of, and some in Mexico, but I'm not a traveler. And I think one of the wonderful things for me is that other people are travelers and they bring back ideas. I can't even imagine this entire country without ashwagandha, for instance. I can't imagine it.
Well, that's why exchanging seeds and is so important and knowledge.
It is. Well, and why we need strictly medicinal.
Yeah.
Risha? Yeah?
I was just going to say ashwagandha is kind of an interesting case in point, because plants will tend to gravitate towards the environment where they've been introduced. And when we first started working with ashwagandha 30 years ago, the seeds were fresh from India, and they were so long seasoned that we barely got a ripe berry from the plants, even when we started them in the greenhouse early and transplanted them out. And now the plants have changed. They're much more short cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that, you know, you choose that one berry from the plant that actually produced the early seed, and you replant that, and then you're beginning a tendency in that strain of plants to produce earlier seeds. And so as you work with the plant and it accommodates itself to your field situation, then it becomes more and more adapted to local conditions, to the point where now when we plant our ashwagandha, which is the same strain that we originally brought in 30 years ago, it always produces lots of berries early enough in the year for us to produce plenty of seed for growers. So, you know, it's not always like a negative tendency when you know you're keeping the plant in your garden for a long period of time. There will be a tendency for the plant to adapt as well, and so this is a really one of the best examples I can think of a plant adapting to local conditions and becoming more and more useful as we collect more and more generations of it.
And it's sort of that botany of desire coexistence, you know, that are we working for the ashwagandha, or is the ashwagandha working for us? You know, that there really is this coexistence with plants as you know them. And I think that you also adapt, you know, that in growing ashwagandha, you are adapting to the plant as well as it adapting to you.
I think that's a good point, and you know, some of these things are plants that we really need these days, like ashwagandha is great for treating a burnout and stress. It's wonderful for, you know, rekindling the fires of sexuality when the coals get cold and it's hard to turn over the old engine again. I find that many times plants that people really need are the plants that are easy to grow for them, and often there's a disconnect, like, you know, people who grow plants for years without ever ingesting them, and of course there's some kind of an etheric connection there, but I think that if you do ingest the plant, then you can often increase the etheric connection as a consequence. So ask yourself, you know, why is this plant growing well for me? And sit with it for a while and allow, you know, allow there to be this connection, you know, and explore that connection, because oftentimes, you know, there's something there for you. And I think of you know, all the people who have, you know, smoked too much pot and just can't really think, or people who have just used their resources to the point where, you know, they're in fight or flight mode as soon as they open their eyes in the morning. And I think about how, you know, helpful the ashwagandha can be in that sense, and how, you know, originally, you know, the plant was used as a dried herb that was then ground up and put on the tongue and taken with some water, and how that is, you know, it really makes sense to look at the way that plants were originally imbibed, and to you know, consider that as being an appropriate way of using them.
Rico, I'm sorry. Richo, I'm sorry, we have to say goodbye. We're just about to go off the air.
And we get to it. Okay, well, so.